Harper Lee had the kind of success most writers can only dream about. Shortly after her novel, To Kill a Mockingbird, came out in the summer of 1960, it hit the bestseller lists. Then it won a Pulitzer Prize, and then was made into an Oscar-winning movie. Her novel has never gone out of print.
But in a move that's unheard of in this age of celebrity writers, Lee stepped out of the limelight and stopped doing interviews years ago. She has never written another book. Still, her influence has endured as we mark the 50th anniversary of its publication. NPR's Lynn Neary examines why this novel has had such a lasting effect on our culture.
On the last day of school at T.C. Williams High School in Alexandria, Virginia, 10th graders straggle into English class for their final exam. Teacher Laurel Taylor stands at the door, reminding this plugged-in generation that they won't be taking the test on a computer.
Yeah, I really collect it. Do you have a pen or pencil with you? You need to get one. Go find a friend.
The world these kids were born into is so different from the way things were 50 years ago when To Kill a Mockingbird was published. Harper Lee's story of Scout Finch and her father Atticus, who defends a black man unjustly accused of rape, came out just as the fight to desegregate schools was getting started. Today, kids of all races sit in Taylor's classroom, and she says many come from all over the world.
And yet they all still find something in that book that kind of resonates. I think that sense of kind of trying to find your identity and realizing that your society doesn't always tell you the right thing and that sometimes you have to go against what everyone else says to do the right thing, all that kind of resonates no matter where you come from.
Taylor first read To Kill a Mockingbird as a student teacher, and her passion for it is still fresh. She nudges her students to talk about the book, asking them what they learned from it. Chachi Wesson-Seggett shyly offers this.
I learned that you shouldn't just say you don't like a certain person based on their culture or skin color or race.
Was there any one character that you kind of liked best?
Scout.
Why?
She spoke her mind and, like, she wasn't afraid of anything.
Mohamed Cisse says his favorite character is Atticus.
He's the only character in the book who is, like, willing to do the right thing, even though he would get a bad name for it. Because a lot of characters in the book, like, wouldn't even dare do that.
When asked whether this book, or any other book for that matter, could change a person's mind, Muhammad says no.
Like, there's still some people right now in this world, like, who still hate black people or hate another race. And I don't think their opinion is going to change just because of a book.
But when To Kill a Mockingbird came out, the world was changing. The civil rights movement was underway, and in 1960, the same year the book was topping bestseller lists, black protesters tried to sit down at whites-only lunch counters in Greensboro, North Carolina. The racism they were battling was so deeply ingrained, it was simply a way of life.
They come in, and they sit down, and we're not used to them sitting down beside us, because I wasn't raised with them, I never have lived with them, and I'm not going to start now.
Joanne Gabin, now a professor of English at James Madison University in Virginia, grew up in the 50s and 60s. She was just a child when she saw a photograph of Emmett Till, a 14-year-old African-American who was viciously murdered after he supposedly whistled at a white woman.
I was traumatized as a child by the whole thought of racism and the fact that children weren't safe in this country. And they weren't safe not because they were bad children. They were not safe because of the color of their skin. So for me, this was a pivotal book.
Gabin read the book at the age of 17. In Tom Robinson, the black man unjustly accused of rape, she saw not a victim, but a hero. He reminded her of her father and grandfather, black men who put up with untold humiliation in order to take care of their families. Atticus Finch gave her hope that there really were white people who would do the right thing. And she believes the book may have helped to make that happen.
I think those people who were determined to keep black people down and other people of color down in this country were not going to be reading this book in the first place and were not going to be influenced. But I think those people who were moderate, who were more liberal, when they got to read To Kill a Mockingbird, they probably wanted to identify with the courageous character of Atticus Finch.
When the film version of To Kill a Mockingbird came out, Atticus became permanently entwined with the actor who portrayed him, Gregory Peck. But whether you first encountered him on page or on screen, Atticus was unforgettable. A modest man of great integrity, he managed to impart his wisdom without being too preachy.
There's been some high talk around town to the effect that I shouldn't do much about defending this man.
If you shouldn't be defending him, then why are you doing it?
For a number of reasons. The main one is that if I didn't, I couldn't hold my head up in town.
The relationship between Atticus and his 6-year-old daughter, Scout, is the emotional heart of the book. And for many girls and women, feisty, fearless Scout is the most memorable character. One such woman is Mary McDonough Murphy.
The story of Scout's initiation and maturing is the story of finding out who you are in the world. And at the same time, the novel is about who we are as a country.
Murphy's new book, Scout, Atticus, and Boo, is based on interviews about To Kill a Mockingbird with well-known writers, journalists, historians, and artists. Murphy says the novel, told from a child's point of view, gave white people, especially in the South, a non-threatening way to think about race differently.
I think the way the book is structured, with all these indelible characters, that the ending is not this kind of triumphant good over evil, Tom Robinson is acquitted. I mean, there's real moral ambiguity to what happens. It all combined to allow them to really question the moral order of things.
The questions raised by the book were part of a conversation that echoed around the country. It's a conversation that's still going on. And the book endures, says Mary McDonough Murphy, because people can relate to it in so many different ways.
It's about race. It's about prejudice. It's about childhood. It's about parenting. It's about love. It's about loneliness. I mean, there's something for everyone in its way, and it's a transforming experience.
To Kill a Mockingbird didn't change everyone's mind, but it did open some, and it did make an impression on many young people who, like Scout, were trying to get a grip on right and wrong in a world that's not always fair. Lynn Neary, NPR News, Washington.
Before he became an award-winning novelist, David Mitchell lived in Japan as a young man teaching English. To write his latest novel, The Thousand Autumns of Jacob de Zoet, Mitchell returned to Japan for 4 years and did historical research in the Netherlands. Book critic Maureen Corrigan says all that legwork paid off.
The critical word on David Mitchell is that he walks on water. Mitchell's first novel, written before he turned 30, was called Ghostwritten. And like his more recent triumph, Cloud Atlas, it's the kind of multi-stranded, intertextual narrative that automatically gets the label experimental slapped on it. Now his latest novel, called The Thousand Autumns of Jacob de Zoet, swerves into the traditional realm of historical fiction. The reader reaction so far has been ecstatic, I think partly because the suspicion lingers that experimental fiction may be too heavy on gimmickry and rather light on story and substance. For a postmodern wunderkind like Mitchell to pull off a straightforward, old-fashioned tale like this one is akin to that perhaps apocryphal story about Michelangelo auditioning before the Pope for the job of painting the Sistine Chapel by drawing a perfect circle, freehand. Far be it from me to give the creatively buoyant Mitchell a dunking in the reviewer's vat of vinegar, though I do have one small brackish water balloon to lob. Overall, The Thousand Autumns of Jacob de Zoet is a beautiful novel, full of life and authenticity, atmosphere, and characters that breathe. It manages to do what the best historical fiction always does, make a reader melancholy, thinking about all those other true life stories from the past that have melted into air. You know right off this is going to be an extraordinary novel because of its setting. The Thousand Autumns of Jacob de Zoet opens in 1799 on an island called Dejima in the harbor of Nagasaki, Japan. As our title hero, Jacob de Zoet, first describes it, the fan-shaped island is man-made, some 200 paces long around its outer curve, and erected, like much of Amsterdam, on sunken piles. Dajima is the province of the Dutch East Indies Company, and its tiny stone bridge over a tidal moat constitutes the sole gateway between samurai-ruled Japan and the outside world. Young Jacob has arrived there to serve 5 years as a bookkeeper, after which he hopes to have amassed enough money to marry the wealthy fiancée waiting for him back in Amsterdam. This island outpost of progress is packed with spies, prostitutes, sailors, slaves, and con men. It's a sliver of the feverish modern world ruled by commerce, wedged up against resolute feudalism. Pious Jacob withstands the usual temptations, but falls hard for a young Japanese woman he meets cute when she runs into his warehouse chasing an ape carrying a severed human leg. I'll skip the explanation. Mitchell revels in, among other things, exuberantly screwball plot twists. Instead, I'll simply say that the woman, Orito Ibagawa, is a midwife whose face was partly disfigured in an accident involving hot oil. She's a wonderful, wry creation, but, and here comes my only criticism of Mitchell's otherwise superb novel, when Miss Ibagawa's adventures take over in book two, the novel mutates into a gothic pastiche, complete with supernatural villain, blood sacrifices, and a labyrinthine prison. Mitchell apparently can do everything when it comes to fiction writing, but he should have resisted this detour into the land of twilight. Fortunately, it's a wrong turn that soon righted. Mitchell's chameleon-like gifts as a novelist are on display everywhere else here, in pages-long drunken conversations over cards, in the delicate negotiations between the Japanese hosts and their Dutch business partners, and in the fabulous action scenes. This is a novel in which we're treated to an earthquake, a typhoon, and a naval battle worthy of Horatio Hornblower. It's the reveries, though, of the exile Jacob de Zoet that make the most indelible impressions. At a decisive moment in the novel, Jacob runs after Miss Ibagawa to tell her he loves her. He's propelled to make this outrageous declaration, we're told, by the inner whisperings of the ghost of future regret. What a wonderful phrase, the ghost of future regret. The same ghost that should be whispering in your ear right now if you have any doubts about reading this strange and singular novel.
Maureen Corrigan teaches literature at Georgetown University. She reviewed The Thousand Autumns of Jacob de Zoet by David Mitchell.
A hilly neighborhood of Los Angeles known as Echo Park is the subject of a debut novel by author Brando Skyhorse. NPR's Mandalit Del Barco spent an afternoon with Skyhorse visiting his old haunts. They're the setting for his book, The Madonnas of Echo Park.
I met up with the 36-year-old writer on a stretch of Sunset Boulevard that cuts through Echo Park.
Well, let's start with your name, Brando.
Yeah, that was my mother's idea. She named me Brando because of Marlon Brando's involvement in Native American activities in the early 70s. You know, he turned down the Academy Award. You know, she decided she was going to name me Brando as sort of an homage to him. And I realized she was just really a big fan of The Godfather.
Brando says his late mother was very involved in the American Indian movement in the 1970s. Even though she'd been born Mexican American, he says his mom identified as Native American.
She got in contact with a man who was incarcerated, and his last name was Skyhorse, and I became Brando Skyhorse. My mother changed her name as well, and she became Running Deer Skyhorse.
It wasn't until later that he learned his biological father had abandoned the family when Brando was three. Paul Skyhorse was just one in a series of stepfathers. Brando's true identity was just one of the enigmas that set him apart in Echo Park, a predominantly Mexican-American neighborhood, a working-class area that was once a backdrop for many silent movies.
The Keystone Cops used to film their first shorts, you know, here in Echo Park. Tom Mix, Charlie Chaplin. You know, they had these fantastic mansions up in Angelino Heights.
When the film industry moved on to nearby Hollywood, Echo Park eventually changed. There was White Flight. Then in the 1970s and 80s, Skyhorse grew up here surrounded by Vietnamese and Mexican immigrants. At the time, Echo Park was known for drive-by shootings.
I was definitely the nerdy kid with the book bag, with the glasses and the whole thing. I didn't hang out with gangs or anything like that. I don't think I even considered it an option because, like, I just wasn't cool enough for that. I wasn't even worthy enough to, like, be hassled by them. I was just totally invisible.
But Skyhorse's outsider status helped him develop an observer's eye for the people he, his grandmother, and mother encountered.
You know, I think what I was exposed to was the working-class element of Echo Park that you don't see in books or movies because it's not as glamorous. I mean, okay, who wants to read a book about somebody going to clean houses all day? Well, that's, you know, interesting to me.
So in his novel, one of Skyhorse's protagonists is a housekeeper who works in the Hollywood Hills. She and other characters are based on some of the people Skyhorse met while growing up in Echo Park.
There were all these sort of, like, you know, weird cast of characters just kind of around the neighborhood. And there was this one elderly lady who used to wear a turban and this lime green coat walking up and down the neighborhood. For some reason, she always, like, stopped at our house because I guess my grandmother was very chatty. And she always stopped by at, like, you know, 1 a.m, pound on the door and say, like, you know, this is the police, open up.
In Skyhorse's novel, she becomes a woman who wears many coats. And in one scene, she encounters the Virgin Mary at a bus stop on Sunset Boulevard.
It's left up to you to decide whether is what she's doing is actually having a hallucination or whether she's crazy or whether she's actually experiencing a miracle that people just are ignoring.
Among others who populate Skyhorse's book are an undocumented day laborer, a recently paroled hustler, and a little girl named Alma. He calls them all Madonnas.
Because every single character is interested in reinvention, becoming more than what you have been told you can become, being more than what you think you're capable of being.
I met some real-life girls from Echo Park, 16-year-olds Brenda Marones, Yesenia Pum, Ana Rivas, and Michelle De Leon. They're writers with the group 826 LA. I asked them to read aloud the central scene from The Madonnas of Echo Park.
Alma used to dance with her mother outside El Guanaco, a mercado near Angelino Heights that sold rock-hard Twinkies, Colt 45s, and homemade tacos and burritos in the back. She and a half-dozen other girls and their mothers gathered there on the corner spontaneously. Then every Friday afternoon, when I recognized El Guanaco in Madonna's music video, Borderline.
In the video, Madonna, dressed as a classic lowrider chola in a 40s-style hair bonnet, white wife beater, long draped coat, and baggy pants that came up to her waist. A short distance away, we heard the sounds of sirens and gunfire.
5 loud gunshots in quick succession. Not firecrackers or popping corn, but deep hammer thrusts. Cut the fleshy air.
Alma was lying on the ground. We all thought she'd fallen and scraped her knee or was playing dead the way little children do all the time in the barrio. When her mother turned her on her side, blood poured out a small hole in front of her neck.
The next day, the Los Angeles Herald Examiner ran a front page picture of Alma in a torn Madonna t-shirt with the banner headline, Baby Madonna Murdered by Heartless Thugs.
Brando Skyhorse says this is the sort of scenario that used to happen all the time when he was growing up.
You know, there would be like a young little girl, she'd be in the wrong place at the wrong time, and, you know, she'd be killed. And there would be this public outcry, and they'd look for the killer, and the killer was never found.
And Skyhorse says he remembers some of the early Madonna videos were shot in the area, the ones where she still looked like a chola, a homegirl from around the way.
There was this discussion that, like, there's this young, attractive Mexican girl who was, like, you know, a pop star. And, like, you know, why is she singing in English? And then, of course, later it came out that she wasn't. But I don't think the people in my neighborhood at least cared. It didn't matter. It was like that was the initial impression. And there was not going to be anything that, like, changed them or dissuaded them from thinking otherwise.
Skyhorse says that memory sparked his interest in revisiting the neighborhood long after he left to go to the acclaimed writing program at the University of California, Irvine, and eventually to become a book editor in New York. The real-life Echo Park girls say he painted a realistic portrait of their hood.
He's trying to show the Latino story of Echo Park. Would you consider yourselves the Madonnas of Echo Park?
Of course.
It's fine and good, you know, to be like the story.
It kind of makes me feel proud to live in Echo Park.
Brando Skyhorse is now working on his next novel, a memoir about growing up with five stepfathers. Mandalit del Barco, NPR News.
At Stanford University, the engineering library is getting rid of 85% of the books and magazines on its shelves. Librarians say that for engineers, paper is becoming obsolete. NPR's Laura Seidel reports.
The periodical shelves at Stanford University's engineering library are almost empty. Helen Josephine, who runs the library, says in the last 5 years, they've moved online.
Those are available through their laptops. Some of them now have even mobile apps, so whenever the student needs to look up information online, it's available to them. They don't need to come to the library to use it.
Josephine says the students are also finding less use for many of the books that are in the library. For years, students would search the indexes of half a dozen volumes looking for the right formula, but not anymore.
Now, with books being digitized and available through full-text search capabilities, they can find that formula quite easily.
While there are some basic formulas in engineering, it's a field that changes rapidly, particularly in specialties like bio and software engineering. Traditional textbooks have rarely been able to keep up. Engineering Dean Jim Plummer says his faculty is increasingly using online books.
So it allows our faculty to change examples, to put in new homework problems, to use new examples and lectures and things like that in almost a real-time way.
The engineering library has 80,000 books on the shelf, and like most libraries, it was acquiring more all the time. They were running out of room. The time had come to build a new library. Michael Keller is the head of Stanford's library system. Instead of creating more space for books, they decided to create less.
As the world turns, they're increasingly digital, and as the world turns, more of the items that appeared in physical form in previous decades and centuries are appearing in digital form.
When the new library opens, there will be 10,000 engineering books on the shelves, a drop of more than 85% from the old library. Keller says they determined which books to keep on the shelf by looking at how frequently a book was checked out. The vast majority of the collection hadn't been off the shelves in 5 years. Keller expects eventually there won't be any books on the shelf of the engineering library. For the moment, it's only the engineering library at Stanford that's cutting back on books, but Keller says he sees what's coming down the pike by looking at the current crop of students in every department.
They write their papers online, and they read articles online, and many, many, many of them read chapters and books online. I can see in this population of students behaviors that clearly indicate where this is all going.
It is still rare among libraries around the country to get rid of such a large amount of books. But the signs are there that libraries are laying the groundwork for a different future. Libraries all over the country are spending more of their money on electronic resources and less on books, according to a survey by the Association of Research Libraries. Librarians like Helen Josephine are looking forward to spending less time with books and more time with people.
That's what we're so excited about, the idea of actually offering more services, offering more workshops, offering more one-on-one time with the students.
But universities that have tried to push students to use more digital books have also gotten some pushback. A group of disabled students sued Arizona State University over its use of the Kindle because it wasn't fully accessible to the visually impaired. Students at Stanford are mixed about the shift. Engineering student Sam Tai was checking out some old-fashioned paper books.
To read books on the screen is kind of tiring for me. So I sometimes like paper form. But if I can access books online, it's much more convenient for me. So I would actually prefer that as well.
And at least for now, Ty can have the option of both. Laura Seidel, NPR News, San Francisco.